The following presentation is brought to you by The Realm Network.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to cartoonist Batten Lash. He's best known for his work on the long-running Exhibit A Press comic book, Supernatural Law. He's also a former student of the late comics master Will Eisner, whose career is celebrated every year the week of March 1st. It's Will Eisner Week. Stick around. And if your lawyer is kind of creepy, he or she may be just what Batten Lash is looking for. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview, brought to you today by Amazon.com. When you visit MrMedia.com and click on any of the links to purchase books, music, movies, gift certificates, or anything else through our Amazon link, you support this free video podcast. Whenever you need something else from Amazon, please consider returning to MrMedia.com to order it. It doesn't cost you any extra, and we sure appreciate the support. And don't forget, MrMedia.com has more than 1,200 celebrity audio and video interviews archived on the site. That's hundreds upon hundreds of hours free entertainment. Subscribe for free on MrMedia.com, and you'll instantly get an email every time a new interview is posted. You can also watch and subscribe to the show on YouTube, Vimeo, Dailymotion, The Realm Network, and Frequency.com. And if you prefer to just listen, Mr. Media is also available for free on iTunes, Spreaker, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Blueberry, TuneIn, Blog Talk Radio, Podfeed.net, and Player FM. You can subscribe to any of those services and never miss another episode. Finally, you can interact with Mr. Media interviews on all kinds of social media, including Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and more. Friend or follow us, we'll friend or follow you back. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience full of vampires, werewolves, and monsters-in-waiting, all seeking legal representation, in the Nooney Media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. What was that?
Oh, that's my my clock.
Oh, okay. It rings at 7, at 23 after the hour?
It's a lazy clock.
Okay. Whether you're an art student or a comics fan, you've probably heard the name Will Eisner at some point. Eisner, whose best-known comics creation, The Spirit, celebrates its 75th anniversary this year, died a decade ago, but his influence is felt as much or more so today than ever before. In celebration of Will Eisner Week, a worldwide celebration of the artist and writer's work held annually from March 1st to 7th, I wanted to do a special show recognizing Eisner's life and work. Helping me to do this today is cartoonist Batten Lash, who was among Eisner's very first students at Manhattan's School of Visual Arts in the mid-1970s. Lash, best known for his comic book Supernatural Law, which began life as a comic strip called Wolf and Bird, Counselors of the Macabre, in the pages of the National Law Journal and the Brooklyn Paper, was a favorite of Eisner's, but not because he thought the young man would ever amount to anything as an artist, and we'll talk about that. You can see I didn't insult Batten. He's smiling. Now, what was it like to be in Eisner's class, learning directly from a master of the comic arts?
Well, I always say this. I may have been an idiot college student, but I knew this was something special. And me and my best pal at SVA at the time, John Holstrom, both were in awe of Eisner, and we knew we were at the feet of the master, as it were. So... I have to admit, I was pretty intimidated, and that probably didn't help the work I was producing during the school year because, you know, you desperately wanted to impress not only a teacher, but a comics legend. And even in, the early 70s, he was larger than life.
Well, Batten, this is going to be embarrassing for me, but that question was actually rhetorical. You're only halfway through the introduction of the show. So that's good, though. I enjoyed that. So I was going to say, what was it like to be in Eisner's class, learning directly from a master of the comic arts? Well, we'll talk about that, too, as well as Lash's time studying under the great Harvey Kurtzman and being Howard Chaykin's assistant. Now I've embarrassed the poor man. I'm sorry. Incidentally, Lash has another long-running tie to the Eisner name. His wife, Jackie Estrada, is the administrator of the prestigious Will Eisner Comic Industry Awards, the Emmys, Oscars, and Tonys of comics, given out annually at Comic-Con International in San Diego. Now, I first interviewed Batten about a dozen years ago for my biography of Eisner, Will Eisner, A Spirited Life, which will be published in a new deluxe illustrated second edition in April. And you can pre-order it now at Amazon.com or any Barnes & Noble store. And that's the end of the press for my own book. If you love art and comics in particular, you won't want to miss this interview, which will include a drawing demonstration by Batten. Oh, and did I mention that Batten Lash is also the man behind the classic comic book The Punisher Meets Archie? I must have left that out. Batten Lash, finally, welcome to Mr. Media.
Hi, Bob. Good to
see you. Good to actually literally to see you this time. I got to ask you, this is the most important question of the whole interview.
Yes.
So I'll give you a second to, fortify yourself for it.
Okay.
With a name like Batten Lash, seriously, yes. Could you have ever imagined doing anything but comics?
No, not at all.
What?
That's why I had to break into the business. Where else would I go? An elevator operator named Batten Lash would just have people frightened to get on the elevator.
And when the comic character Bat Lash came out, did you file like copyright infringement?
Oh no. He was first. It's a long story, and that's that's for my exclusive Mr. Media interview. When we're not talking about Will.
All right. So let's talk about Will. Take us back to the 1970s. First of all, how did you wind up at SVA, the School of Visual Arts in Manhattan?
Well, I always wanted to be a cartoonist, and when I was a kid, growing up to become a fanatical fan, in the letter pages where they would occasionally have biographies of the cartoonists who would draw whatever title it is, maybe 8 out of 10 would say they attended the Cartoonist and Illustrator School, which was the original name for School of Visual Arts. And it occurred to me, wow, you could really go to school for this sort of thing. So when it came time in high school to pick out a college you wanted to go to, I have to admit I wasn't too interested in college per se, but I wanted to go to art school. So I picked SVA, put together a portfolio, and I was accepted. Once I got there, they didn't have cartooning classes. So that's when I met my partner in crime, John Holstrom. We both connected and bonded over the idea of doing comics, and we were crazy about comics. And we and a few other students lobbied to get some cartooning classes reinstated in SVA. And at the time, I mean, SVA now has campuses all over the city, but at the time they only had two buildings, one on 23rd Street and one on 21st. And it was a very small, intimate school. It's so small that you can go into the student lounge and the president of the school would be sitting there having a cup of coffee. So he was very approachable. And Tom Gill, who ran the Alumni Society, he might have been the first professional cartoonist I ever got to know, because he drew the Lone Ranger for years for newspaper strips, and he did a lot of comic books for Gold Key and Dell. And Tom said, well, you guys, you should just put together a list of people you want to have as instructors, and I'll go with you to lobby Silas Rhodes. He was the president of SVA at the time. So, I remember Holstrom and I said, who do you want at the top of the list? He goes, well, Kirby's in California. Let's put it down Eisner and Kurtzman. And we said, yeah. Just out of respect, because there's no way the school's ever going to hire them. They're just too big. And, we got 30 people, 30 students committing themselves to take the class, and that's what they needed to to add a new class. And I remember seeing Silas Rhodes in the lobby of the school, and he went, "Hey, boys, you should know Will Eisner and Harvey Kurtzman are going to be your instructors next year." You could have knocked us over with a feather. And that's how it began. Just very simple. If you don't ask, you don't get.
Isn't that like the greatest lesson that a young person can learn? If you Absolutely. Don't ask.
That's right. You know, it's the old Woody Allen line. 80% of success is showing up. You know, the other 20% is just asking.
So tell us about the your introduction to Will, first of all, and we'll talk about Harvey as well. It wasn't the day that you showed up for class, as I recall.
No. We didn't know what to expect. We didn't even know what Will looked like. At the time, this is the early 70s, and
there was no internet? You couldn't just look up his picture on the internet in the 70s?
Not
what?
Only there no internet, there was no... The Spirit had been out of print for a while. All we had was, I think, the kitchen... I think only one Kitchen Sink Underground came out. There was a reprint in Pfeiffer's Comic Book Hero, and Stranko had just come out with the second edition of his History of Comics that had a great Spirit story reprinted. And pretty much that's what we were going by. But Will sent a note to the president of school, who got in touch with all the students that committed to take Will's class in September. Eisner would like to meet all of you. Just sort of an orientation. And this was the end of May, so it would be the end of our first year. And I believe it was the week before the last week of May, which is when school would have ended. And I'll never forget my first thought seeing Will come into the class. And and at the time, I'm sure it's pretty much the same SVA, the classes were just these big rooms where art students would sit around drawing a model. So it was very big. Will came walking through the door, and my first thought was, he's a lot taller than I thought he would be. And he took a chair, spun it around, sat down, and he said, "I wanted to talk to you guys. I wanted to meet the people that are going to be in my class in September." And he went down, introduced, you know, got everyone to say their name, introduced himself, and pretty much spelled out what he was looking for. The school had agreed on his, I don't know what you would call it, his format for the class, where he wanted each student to either complete a comic book story or do some function for a story, like whether it's production or coloring or whatever. And they would put the school at the school's cost would put together a comic book that would be published featuring the students that are selected in that anthology. So it wasn't a guarantee that just because you took the class, you were going to get in that book. You had to pass Will's approval. So he kind of spelled that out, and it was all very, very exciting. And again, something that just stuck with me and Holstrom too is like Will said, after going through, you'll write and draw, we'll walk you through the production of producing a comic book, and you will get to keep the copyright of your own work. And that's very important, and he stressed that. Mm-hmm. And this had to be May 1973, and that always stuck with us.
And we should take a minute here and talk about your partner in crime, John Holmstrom, who's a fascinating fellow himself.
Yes.
Can you give a little brief bio on what John's career was like?
John has had probably the most interesting and fascinating career of anyone I know, because he just went from when I met him, and I'm sure he'll be embarrassed by this, you know, we both wanted to do Marvel Comics. Here is the guy that was the creator of Bosco and did the covers for the Ramones. At one point, he wanted to draw. I remember him showing me a drawing of the Human Torch he did. But he's just, you know, I think he found his real calling during Eisner and Kurtzman's class, that he was like a real bona fide cartoonist in every sense of the word, alternative cartoonist in every sense of the word. I mean, before, not to take anything away from Peter Begg or alternative cartoonists like that, but, you know, John had this in-your-face style from the get-go. And very brutal, very funny. John was a very brutally honest, opinionated guy. Very, very bright. I saw him just recently, and he's still like that. So you should devote a whole show to him, because he's just gone through so many different and the people he's met and run into during the course of his career. But at the time, we were both very aware of Eisner and Kurtzman's stature. And it got back to us. A couple of guys in the class would make fun of me and John, saying, look at those two up front taking notes. They're writing down everything Eisner says. And I should say that John and I had a pact with each other that if we did not see each other by 8:45 Thursday morning, because Will's class was Thursday morning, 9 o'clock, we were to call each other and say, get out of bed. You don't want to miss this. And during that year, we never missed a class.
That's amazing. That's amazing. And I got to add something to your description of John for people who don't make the connection. He's also the co-founder of Punk Magazine.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's his brainchild. Yeah.
You know, and Punk was John and Legs O'Neill. And there was a third guy whose name I always forget, and I apologize.
Great, Dunn. I think his last name. Jed Dunn.
Jed, that's it. Jed Dunn. Yes. Yeah. Thank you. So thank you for giving credit where I couldn't do it. So, folks, we're going to move on from the subject of John, sort of. But if you want to know more about John, go search that name online, or search John and Punk Magazine if you need to keep it simple.
He has a Facebook page.
He is there. He's an interesting guy. All right, so
hold it. Time for another question.
What is that? What is that?
Oh, that's my clock here in the studio.
But it's like 38 after the hour. It's not.
Well, it's a lazy clock.
I see. Okay. Nice. Very nice. All right. Back to Eisner. Yeah, that's it. Yes. So the year starts. Your second year at SVA starts, and you're going to have a class with Eisner and a class with Kurtzman the same year, right?
So yes.
Did you get introduced to Kurtzman before the semester started, or not until?
No. In fact, we met Harvey the first day of his first class. And we didn't know what to expect. We didn't really know what he looked like. I wasn't really in fandom, and neither was John. So if there were pictures published of them in fanzines, we didn't see them. And in comes Harvey on Tuesday. His class was Tuesday afternoon at 2 o'clock, I think. One or 2 o'clock. It was in the afternoon on Tuesdays. So Harvey's class was... We had that before Will's class, even though we met Will first. So Harvey comes walking into his first class with a six-pack of Pepsi. At that, you know, it's so charming, and he was going to share with the class. Now John and I, of course, were in awe of Harvey, so we didn't take any soda. We just wanted to chat with him, and he pretty much had a very, very, very casual kind of briefing. Yeah, Harvey's, you know, I think he was aware of his achievements, but he was pretty much a very modest guy, very low-key type of guy. There was a couple upstarts, nothing harmful, though, a couple upstarts in the class that would blurt out stuff, and Harvey would be very patient, let them say their little gags and just continue on. You know, he took from there. I think it took him a couple of weeks to really get his sea legs with his SVA class. Will, though, from the get-go, the very first class on that Thursday, it was step out of line, you're out. You know, because he ran a shop. You know, I even though Harvey was an editor, and I don't think he had to be a ringleader of a shop full of freelance artists. like Will did. So Will was very used to the eccentric artist, the temperamental artist, the lazy artist, and he just knew how to make sure the bull session stops at a certain point, and you know, his word was law, let's put it that way.
So
he was very pleasant, though.
Well, I was going to say, I think what you're getting at here is that, you know, you've gone from no comics instructors to two legendary guys who are completely different in their approach, and I imagine what you learned in each of the classes was completely different as well.
Yes. Yes, even though I like to think I took a little bit from column A and a little bit from column B, everything, like, you know, I found out, and I have to admit, I found out the hard way, and I always say this, I have never gone through a major change in my life without kicking and screaming all the way. I mean, there was a certain viewpoint I had and a certain approach I had to what I thought the way you do comics, and it was the wrong way. It was not the end result was not good looking. It was, you know, like everyone starting out, every amateur starting out, it's awkward. That's the best way to put it. It was awkward looking. And just the great thing about Harvey was he'd go in the middle of the classroom and everyone would surround him as he'll show his technique. And his technique I found fascinating, where he'd do a rough drawing, then put a sheet of bond paper over that and trace over that rough drawing. Then he'd put another sheet over it and tighten that until he had something that, and this is Kurtzman's, genius, where we've all seen Harvey's finished drawings. It looks like, it's like, hoo-ha, you know, just like very spontaneous. But watching Harvey work, it was painstakingly meticulous. And, you know, and over the years, my definition of genius is someone that makes the very difficult look incredibly easy. And that's what he did. Will, on the other hand, he wouldn't do many drawing chalk talks, I should say. You know, occasionally he would. I remember when he was showing us inking, because as Harvey would put it, a lot of us were inking, and it was technique out of control. And, you know, and Will kind of had that same philosophy of, you know, no, you're putting unnecessary technique in something. And I remember him sitting down and he goes, here, this is, well, let me show you something. He goes, you just get the maximum effect with the least amount of effort. And he sat down, took a paintbrush, an inking brush, and, you know, wet it with his tongue, dipped it in. And again, it was 1, 2, 3. He just rendered just the barest of sketches into what familiar Eisner thing. I think he kind of did like he didn't do the spirit. It was just a guy, you know, maybe a businessman or something, but he had the folds and the tie. It was just fantastic. But that was rare. Harvey would always demonstrate. Every couple of weeks we'll have to gather around him and he'll demonstrate. His coloring, to this day, I still use what I learned in his class on how he colors things with the watercolor, just building it up. But I have to say, in all honesty, I had to reflect on all that stuff after the year because, again, I'm very intimidated by the two giants,
right, even though
they were very nice. And they weren't ogres. It wasn't like they were browbeating any of us. At times they must have thought I was out of my mind because, you know, they're being very nice to me and I'm like, how do you open this? And it's like, well, let me show you. So, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, it's fine. It seems like one of the differences that Will, who always liked to fancy himself the businessman, was always very focused on production efficiency, getting it done and moving on to the next. I mean, when he, in the 40s, when he had first the Eisner and Iger shop and then his shop with Busy Arnold and then later PS, it was all about getting the work done and moving on to the next thing.
Right.
Even though, I mean, this is to take nothing away from his artistic strengths and his ability, but he could get it done pretty quickly. He knew what he wanted to do, and then he moved on.
Right.
It seems like Harvey was more focused on, you know, the very specialness of the line and the presentation. You were there. I wasn't. I'm just thinking that that's been my takeaway from the two of them.
I think you're correct about that, because I think Harvey wanted to do the best job possible. I remember him going on about Jack Davis. He loved Jack Davis's work. In fact, he even brought Davis to the class to talk. But in a private conversation, I remember Harvey telling us that. Said, the thing about Jack is, I kept telling him, slow down, slow down. You're just knocking some stuff out. You've got to, you know, just concentrate on something. He goes, I'd much rather see one perfect story than 10 different ones. And if you look at the frontline combat and the two-fisted tail things that Davis did with Harvey, it shows. I mean, I love the horror stuff, but it's far superior to his Tales from the Crypt stuff. I think Harvey called it, he had a hairy style. but you know, he was a brilliant artist. But I think Harvey always liked, and again, that's something else I got from Harvey, too. I think he always thought that, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I think he had an idea what the story should look like, and he was the captain of that ship. And on the occasion where I will write for someone, I will insist that the artist has to follow my layouts. Like, you know, and Harvey's philosophy was that this was his story, and you know, you're the artist. Here you go. And you know, some people agree with that, and others. I mean, I've worked with some cartoonists that were really put off that they had to follow my layouts. Then others just, they were happy for it. But I have to segue here. But along those lines, I did an Archie story with Dan DiCarlo, and I was thrilled that the great Dan DiCarlo was going to draw one of my Archie stories. And when I finally met him at a convention, he said, you know, I told the editor at Archie, Baton Lash ever does a script, I want to draw it. I thought, oh my God, what a thrill. And it's like, wow. And he goes, I go, really? He goes, yeah, because you do half the work for me.
And
Dan says, and I said to the editor, if this guy's dumb enough to do half of my job, I want to be with him. So that brought me to earth pretty
That's
quick.
That's pretty funny.
But still, you know, I agree with Harvey where, you know, if you're writing the story, you are the captain of that ship, and that is your vision. And, you know, if you work with an artist that's willing to go that way, great. If not, then you don't have to do it.
So it seems like Will's class was particularly structured, and that Harvey's maybe a little less so. Is that
right? I think Harvey came in every day with what he wanted to accomplish during that, whether it was a guest speaker, a demonstration, or just introducing us to comics on a global sense. Again, I'll never forget, he came the first time I ever saw Pilot or Metal Herland, I hope I'm saying that correctly, was in Harvey's class. He brought in a big stack of European magazines and albums, as they were called back then. And he plops them on the desk and he says, I am bringing these here to show all of you there is more to comics than Marvel Comics. Even though he never really came out and said it, you can tell him and Will kind of... they weren't crazy about what was going on at Marvel or DC. I don't know. I mean, I think it's hard to say. Marvel was always the they would look at what was going on at Marvel and kind of, you know, like no, that sort of thing.
Well, of course, I mean, think about it. I mean, they both came up in a time that comics were fairly simple. Continuity was simple. There really was no reliant or guarantee that you'd have continuity, even in, you know, the long-running things. Marvel right. comes along, and I think the reason Marvel stood out in the 60s and 70s was it was about continuity and story and a connected universe. If this happened over here, just like the Marvel movies are now, yes. if this happens here, it affects what happens over here. And right. that was out of the realm of their comics experience. So they probably related better to DC, which was still kind of soft on, you know, that kind of stuff.
That's right. Yeah, no, that is true. In fact, Will had Saul Harrison, who was the production manager for DC at the time, come in to talk to the class. And I remember Saul being a little irked because there was a real diehard continuity-minded fan in the class that kept badgering about questions about why isn't Batman consistent with... Now, I'm not getting on my high horse because we were all agreeing with that guy because we were all diehard comic fans. But again, we didn't want to risk Will's wrath after. But it was funny how Will put that guy, that student. He goes, hey, I have an idea. Write a letter to Saul and tell him, put it all in a letter. So that was his way of saying, let's move on.
Now, we talked about, you developed this lifelong friendship with John Holmstrom at SVA. Who else was in the Eisner and Kurtzman classes with you?
Well, I guess the one that really went on to big Marvel and DC fame was Bob Wiechek, who I always remember as the first guy I ever saw use whiteout for highlights rather than corrections.
Oh.
And I remember looking over his shoulder and going, wow, nice little effect he got there. And even then, he had a great line work. We also, Paul Marenghelli, who went on to work for Harvey and under Joe Simon and Sid Jacobson, Ken Lager, who was in both our classes, he was this terrific illustrator. I mean, really, from the NC Wyatt School. I don't want to put words in Ken's mouth. I think he wanted to go into comics until he. An angel gets up swing. I think he headed into illustration because he was also an excellent painter, and he's done Western covers and. Film noir type covers for, a line of crime novels. I mean, he very prolific, and I was glad I just reconnected him after many years through Facebook. So, and he's still the same old Ken. John Landy, who Will eventually hired as an assistant, and he worked on, I think, The Warren Spirits, doing production work, and some stuff for Poorhouse Press, which was Will's little imprint. Oh, and I just found out just recently when I reconnected with John Holstrom, I should say that there was a big gap of many years I didn't see John or speak to him, not because we had a falling out, but just because we just went in many very different directions. But I saw John recently at a convention a couple months ago, and I just found out that after SVA, Will hired him, and he was sort of the, I don't want to say gopher, but sort of like all-around shop assistant when Will had his Park Avenue South.
Wait a minute, Ben. I gotta interrupt you here.
Sure.
You learned that after reading A Spirited Life, right? Because that story was in there. That's where you learned that story.
Was it? Yeah. Well, you know, you got to remember now in my later years, my short-term memory.
I apologize for interrupting for a second, but John, Will really took to John. He took to both of you, but he really took to John, and John was having a hard time financially. So Will created a job for him. He had him sweeping up. He had him doing things in the office. And later, when John and Legs and Jed started Punk magazine, yeah. Will gave them his own desk.
That's right. That's what I was going to say.
Yeah.
Which is funny. No. I probably did read it in your book. I just blanked on it.
That's okay.
No, in fact, a couple of months ago when I saw John, it was the first time I spent that much time with him in 40 years. Because, after 74, we went our separate ways. And the other coincidence was Will gave John his desk, and Punk had an office in 225 Lafayette Street, which is where Mad started and Harvey would work. And later on, in the mid-'80s, I would have a studio there.
Wow.
So it's just funny how it just – it's like an episode of Lost.
That I didn't know. That's really good. I wish I could put that in the book now, but production on the second edition is done. But that's really good. I did not know that cyclical nature of that. We'll keep talking, but I know there are people who are now that we've teased them that you're going to do some drawing. Why don't we get you set up with your drawing board, and we'll keep talking. And
all right.
What would you like to draw first? What do you have in mind? Wolf and birds, some supernatural law, spirit.
Well, since we're talking about Will, let me try the spirit.
Okay.
I don't know if you can. I'll just move back here.
Yeah, perfect.
All right. And you know, a thing that fascinated me about, and again, it's funny what you pick up over the years. Like I said, how to this day I still I've appropriated Harvey's technique for sketching and coloring. From Will, I was fascinated. He brought in some of his spirit originals, and first of all, we were all impressed because they were gigantic.
Yeah, the boards, the original boards, were even bigger then than they are now.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
Far better.
But what I was fascinated with was that I saw panels were pasted over, and there was like a lot of correction with new drawings over the corrections. And I said, did you redraw these things? And he goes, well, you know, when Warren wanted to reprint the stuff, they wanted to reprint it from the original art. Will kept most of his original art. He said, I looked at it, and I said, you know, I could do better than this. And I was fascinated. And again, to this day, when I reprint my stuff, I look at, because I keep all my original art, I look at certain panels, maybe whole sequences, and say, I could do better. Mm. And I will redraw the whole thing. And that was something I got from Will's class.
Now, Batten, can you back up just a little bit?
Yeah.
And we just want to keep you and your drawing in frame. I think I know where you're going with that sketch. I think I recognize that already. And while you draw for a second, let me say, here's some other names of people who later went through Eisner's class, and probably Kurtzman's class as well. The guy you may have heard of named Joe Quesada at Marvel was the most famous failure in the class. He failed the class. Neil Gaiman's best friend, boyhood back in England, Jeff Notkin, he went through the class. Florian Bacaleda, who went on to be the art director at Vibe and Spin and some other things. Now that I've started this, I'm going to Brian Postman in comics went through the class. I'm coming up a little short on some names.
Well, even outside of comics, there's a fellow named Paul LaPelletier who made it very successful in the advertising world and kept in touch with Will up until the end. Mm-hmm. And who else?
I'm going to cheat. I'm going to look at the book.
Kyle Baker, did you mention him?
Did Kyle I didn't realize Kyle was a student.
I believe he was a student. And by the way, about Joe Quesada,
yeah.
The only reason he failed Will's class is that he didn't attend because
right.
Will once told Jackie and I that he would never fail anyone unless they never showed up. And I guess Joe never showed up.
That was it. I'll tell you how it worked. Joe later went to he met Will much later, and he had said to him he reintroduced himself. Here it is, right out of the book. Years later, Quesada was the Marvel's editor in chief, and he reintroduced himself to Eisner at a comic book convention. And during the course of the conversation, Quesada said, "By the way, I took your course and failed." And Eisner said, "And here you are." You know, I mean, it all worked out. There were a lot of very successful people who went through that class, whether they wound up in comics or not. It's fascinating. And I'm constantly hearing from people who said, "Oh, I've got a story about being in this class." Oh, Drew Friedman. How did I forget Drew? Yeah.
And Mike Collin, when he was in both their classes.
He was actually Ness. And there's another story. There's a story that Carlin told about Will was doing these joke books at the time for Scholastic, right. And he was paying his students $1 a joke if they sold him something funny. So I think Carlin said he sold him 300 jokes. These were books for like Star Jaws, which was a takeoff on Star Wars and Jaws. 101 outer space jokes, superhero jokes, spaced out jokes, funny jokes and foxy riddles, star nuts, 300 horrible monster jokes. That sounds like one of something you would have done.
Yeah.
Bringing up your parents, dates and other disasters. So anyway, enough of me. What do you got there?
Well, I got this. I got Denny Colt here, which doing my best and failing Will Eisner imitation. But I just want to mention something. You mentioned those joke books and everything, and I've heard people dismiss them and kind of like turn their nose up saying this is beneath Will. But it wasn't, because a thing that he stressed in the class, and again, it takes years later and you understand it when you're out on your own, he saw a market, and there was a market for those joke books. Mm-hmm. And he applied his cartoon. I mean, whether they're good funny or not, I mean, that's up to the reader. If you're a young kid, I don't think you care. There's just goofy stuff. But he found the market, and that's another thing he stressed. In 1973, 74, when we had him as a teacher, comics, they were not doing well. The newsstands the mom-and-pop newsstands were closing up, or they weren't carrying comics anymore. There was a paper shortage. The paper was really bad. We all remember, you could see the other side of the page. And I remember Will holding up a copy of a current Marvel comic, and he says, "I flip through and all I see is ads," because like every other page was an ad. And Will said, it was the first time I heard the saying, which became my favorite saying. I would hear him say it many times. When everyone was talking about the demise of the comics business, I remember Neil Adams came to the class one week and said, "There'll be no comics industry by 1980, because that's how bad it is. And after Neil left, Will said, "I've seen this business die 3 times already." And he goes, "There's always a market, and it's up to you to find that market." I was impressed when Mike Plue came to talk to the class. Star Magazine, the tabloid, had just started. And when people were saying, "Well, what about the newsstands? They're not carrying comics," Plug said, "Well, there's a new publication, Star. Has anyone gone there and see if they need a comic strip?" I remember being very impressed by that. Like, yeah, just, again, you go back, you have to ask. The worst they could say is no. But it's so true. I mean, of course, 1980 has come and gone, and even though comics looked in bad shape in the 70s, the direct market came up, and there was a market. And then when the direct market was beginning to sink 10 years ago, the internet opened up a whole new vista for selling comics and doing comics. So, you know, whenever I hear people, you know, say, "Oh, this is the end," I always think of Will saying, "Oh, not really."
Well, you know, I do. I have like an hour-long presentation on Will that I do at. I've done it at libraries and museums, and for art students and comics fans, of course. And people are always surprised to hear that Will's two best-selling works that he made the most money from over his lifetime. Number one was The Complete World Bartender's Guide, and number two was Robert's Rules of Order, The Standard Guide to Parliamentary Procedure. And I said this in the book 10 years ago, the Complete World Bartender's Guide earned him more than $500,000. And the reason for that was because he figured out that both books would be a lot more popular if they had illustrations. If you're a bartender, it didn't really help you, probably, you know, maybe a certain level of education in there too, but it didn't help you to have a book that described the glass you should pour a martini in or a margarita or whatever. Right. Will said, I'll draw the actual glass, and that book, it still sells. And the same thing with Robert's Rules of Order. He drew illustrations to describe what the book was about, and that's where he made his money. He, you know, the spirits was a nice source of income over time, and you know, he kept the rights, and business, of course, was a big part of his thing. But that wasn't where he made his living. He made his living on these things that were more commercial and that were more practical.
Yeah, well, that in between period from when he came for his own personal orientation, SVA, to when the class started, he also had a sit down with the students. Says, come up to my offices on Park Avenue South, and I can't remember exactly what it was. It might have been a more refined curriculum that he was going to show us. But I remember going up to American Visuals, and there were all sorts of public service posters and comic books about that I used to get in school when you know, I was in grammar school, about how to brush your teeth or how to, you know, hygiene and things like that. And it was all very, very buttoned down. Within a year, it was after The Spirit was being published by Warren, which came out, I think, in January of 74. The next year, that next summer, when John and I went up there, the walls were covered with Spirit posters, and he was back in action.
Right.
So, but the point is that Will loved comics. I think he had a vision of comics, but he knew. I think this is why he was so impatient with the Marvel product, that he just saw how limited it was, and the niche audience that it was catering to. Even back then, he was talking about comics for a classroom and teaching kids math and science and things like that. And this is what he was doing with PS. That, you know, again, people kind of dismiss that as, oh, why did he waste all his time with the military? Well, one, I think he thought it was his patriotic duty. Two, it was an incredible payday, I'm sure. And three, he really wanted to push the comics medium, that not only was an entertainment medium, but it was also a learning medium. And it was a very successful venture.
Now, at the beginning of the show, I mentioned that while you were certainly a favorite of Will's and you had a good relationship with him, he was not exactly encouraging to you about your actual artistic talent. Am I overstating it there?
Just a little bit. Okay. It really, going back to me and Holstrom, I always felt that we were the Gallant and Goofus of, if you remember Scholastic magazine, the Gallant and Goofus of his class, where John could do no wrong and I could do no right. But between Harvey and Will, I made the effort, and they appreciated that. The only discouraging thing was that they didn't think I had a future in comics, because the cartooning they didn't find very good. But they both acknowledged that I was a very creative person and my ideas were very funny. And at the time I was doing videos, I was writing my own scripts, casting and directing them. In fact, during that time I was doing, this 1974, I want you to know, doing the musical version of Night of the Living Dead. And I was, you know, it was like the mad parody of it, where sung to the tune of that type of thing. And you know, I thought it was beneath Harvey and Will's notice, but they knew what I was working on. They said, yeah, we see what you're doing, man. That's very inventive and it's very funny. That may be where your destiny is. But, you know, all my life I wanted to be a cartoonist, and I just couldn't crack that cartoon nut. You know, it was just technique out of control, just all over the map. And John like I said earlier, he found his niche early on. Even though when I met him, he wanted to break into comics, doing Marvel comics or whatever it was, I think he very quickly found out that he was a cartoonist that would be very much at home with the undergrounds and later on what we would call an alternative cartoonist. So once he realized that, he took off like a rocket. So I still had to find myself.
All right. Well, this is what I want to. I don't want to miss out on this. So after you were done at SVA, you went away from cartooning for a while. You did creative things, but you were a little less focused on cartooning, right?
Right.
So take us through you're finishing at SVA and then up to the point where you start doing Wolf and Bird, Counselors of the Macabre.
Let me try and sum
I know
I'm
compacting a lot of time
there. Yeah, I'm not. Let me try and compact it and keep the audience interested too. I was a little stunned because, you know, all my life I wanted to be a cartoonist and it didn't look like that was going to be my future. And at the same time, even though I was a feverish comic fan, I was gradually losing interest in comics. I wasn't too thrilled with there was one or two exceptions, but I wasn't too thrilled with what was going on with Marvel, with DC. It just seemed like the best days were behind them. I mean, the excitement of Kirby and Ditko and Stranko. Around this time, Adams was even moving on to other things. It just lost the pizzazz. So one day, every Tuesday I would go to the newsstand to see what the new releases were. And one Tuesday I woke up and I did other things. I just went cold turkey. But there was only one comic I bought. And it was the Spirit magazine. Because now, after... first, I loved the covers. Now, after the class was over, I was just going to take a look at the story. The pressure of the school year was off. I was just saying, what makes these stories tick? You know, let me just assimilate. So even though I was writing scripts, I had written a few screenplays, very little, that I would try to film on my own. Then I met a few people that had some sort of connection with Hollywood that I was able to just get some scripts out there. And even though I wasn't reading comics, I was still drawing, not so much storyboards, but what my characters in my scripts should look like. And a friend of mine, a very good friend of mine, Russell Calabrese, who is an animator for Warner's and Disney, and I met him in SVA. He was in one of my videos, and he's looking at my production notes, and he sees the sketches. And this before I got to know him very well. He just said, "Are you doing comic books?" And I go, "No, why do you ask?" He goes, Why are you doing this? He goes, "You should be doing comics." I go, "Oh, well, I'm not very good." "What are you talking about? These are great." "Really?" He goes, "Look at this." And so, I mean, it was quite a while that anyone told me that the work was good. But, you know, I guess without even realizing it, I was just improving.
You grew into your ambition.
Right. I grew into it. And I had told you during the summer of 74, I guess this was before John got his job with Will. I can't remember exactly why. I think Will just needs some muscle guys to move some furniture. So he asked me and John to go up there just to help clean out American Visuals, throw out excess stuff. Two things that I remember him showing us. He goes, "Oh, I just got this thing in the mail, and I like to see artists, especially people who have been in the field for quite a while, go in this direction." And it was a Xerox. And when I say Xerox, it was the Xerox of 1974, where it's not black. It's gray, but you could still make out the images. And it was like this thick, and it was the first chapter of the First Kingdom by Jack Katz. And he goes, "Yeah, Jack Katz." He goes, "Yeah, you know, he worked during the 40s and 50s. And I'm so thrilled to see that he's trying to do something that is really what we would call today outside of his comfort zone. And of course, we all know The First Kingdom was one of the seminal self-published independent comics that would have a large platform during the 80s. But he had asked, Jack had asked Will for a blurb, and Will was very happy to give it to him. Also that day, another thing that affected how I would look at comics, and it was inspiring in its own goofy way. He had a copy of Graphic Story magazine, and it was an interview with Howard Nostrand on the cover. And it was this fabulous illustration of like a walking corpse carrying a armful of comic book pages.
I've seen that guy. I know that guy.
Yes. I seen him at some conventions too, looking for work. But Will said, he goes, this Nostrand guy, he goes, I didn't really like what he said about me and Bob Powell, but it's a very interesting interview. And he gave me the magazine. I had never heard of Nostrand. And he was a guy that took the best of Jack Davis, the best of Wally Wood, the best of Eisner, the best of Kurtzman, and kind of put it in a stew and came up with his own style. I was fascinated with this. And also, he was a guy who had this large body of work I had never heard of. At first, I thought it was an elaborate prank that he was this guy from between the Golden and the Silver Age that did this lion's share of work for horror comics, not even EC. But he was very erudite and funny. And I remember his analysis of Harvey and Will's style, I was really taken with. And that and John Benson's interview with Gil Kane really turned my head around about comics. In the late 70s, by this time, I see I was getting nowhere with plays or screenplays. And the problem with those things, too, was there seemed to be so many stages you had to go through to get what you wanted. And even if you got what you wanted, the few productions that I did do, there were so many people involved. You had to count on actors and a camera person. And if you're doing a play, you had to find a venue. It's like, oh my God, there's just so many elements and expensive. But the thing about comics that I always liked, that all you really needed was a pencil, paper, and yourself and your imagination. And you've got a whole world right in front of you. And you don't have to count on anybody. So I think towards the end of the 70s, I was drifting more towards comics. But even though I would look at the newsstand, comics, it still didn't appeal to me. I felt that was behind me. The Spirit magazine had been discontinued. But looking over those magazines, the Howard Nostrand interview, the John Benson thing, I had sent away for some Graphic Story magazine. There was an incredible interview with Alex Toth. And again, all this was the aesthetics. Comics theory I was learning, and I was fascinated with it. So that was sort of informing what would eventually go into my new phase of cartooning. Since there was not going to be a screenplay or theater, I better put my portfolio together. I could still draw, and it seemed a couple of people did like my artwork. Let me see if I can get some freelance gigs, not so much in comics, but in just illustration. There was still a market for, if someone wrote an article, they wouldn't go to Photoshop. They would hire an artist to illustrate like a column or something like that. And I always remembered Mike Plew's advice. It's like, well, why don't you just ask if they need an artist or a cartoon for something? And that's what I did. And I would just go around to whatever I could find, asking if they would take an illustration. And one of my first jobs right out of the gate was for Swank magazine. They had they wanted a color illustration of something to do with Playboy. And it was probably the only drawing of a female that was fully clothed too, because she was in a space outfit. But they paid me $100 for it, and I could still do it. Someone does like it, and that's why I learned, art is very subjective. This guy may think you suck, but this one says, hey, not bad. So you can't take it to heart. You just have to just keep moving ahead. All this led me to a friend of mine, Johnny Ganna, who went to SVA. I had known him there, and he was a photographer. But at the time, he was working as an account executive for a newspaper in downtown Brooklyn called the Brooklyn Paper. And he called me up and said, hey, why don't you bring, are you still drawing? I go, yeah. In fact, I'm bringing my book around, showing people. He goes, oh, I think they need some artwork for the ads they're doing. I go, okay, sure. So I went up there and hit it off right away with them. And I was their go-to guy because, whatever they needed, they go, we need an Easter basket. Can you draw one? I go, yeah, sure. Yeah. We need whatever. A puppy being in a dog bath or something. Can you draw that? Sure. And I'd be there on the nights they would go to press to do whatever last minute artwork they needed. And it was very exciting. I would go with the publisher to the printer and help him, this is really dating myself, but look at the film and just block out any sort of cut lines or anything, because back then everything was pasted by hand. So, again, remembering Mike Plug's great advice, just ask. I say, well, you guys are a newspaper. Do you want a comic strip? And they said, well, sure. You want to come up with one? And I go, well, yeah. And I said, my provision is I have to keep the copyright. And they go, yeah, no problem. So pretty much Wolf and Bird came out of that, I had the green light, and all I needed was the thing to put in the paper. So it came shortly after that.
And let me ask you, do you want to draw something else while we still have a few more minutes? And we can keep talking about Wolf and Bird.
Oh, okay. Well, this is a great segue because I will draw, I think, over here.
That's perfect.
Okay.
So let's wait. We'll wait for the clock. But
okay,
it's done. So, Wolf and Bird, Counselors of the Macabre.
Right.
What was the concept there? What were you?
Well, downtown Brooklyn is filled with attorneys, mm-hmm. and not just attorneys, but at the time, and I'm sure it's still pretty much the same. Very small, one man, two man, And I use the word man in the general sense, it's like two woman operations, and the Brooklyn Paper would be distributed to these offices. In fact, that's one of my many jobs, that I would help distribute the paper every day it came out. And I would notice there was every possible type of attorney. There was, real estate and family and everything you can think of. Again, back to Eisner, I just remember seeing the high ceilings and the way the sunlight would be cast and the shadows. Like, wouldn't it be funny if there was a law firm just for monsters? And it was before I knew of something called natural law, which is where supernatural law is a play on. I said, wouldn't it be funny, just two nondescript attorneys, and no one would even blink an eye because they're all hustling for clients down there. So this is just, these two attorneys, Wolf and Bird, their clients are kind of, just keep away from them. They're kind of rotting corpses, but just, or don't go in this building at night because vampires have a tendency to drop in on them. So I was just walking around and I thought, maybe I'll do that for the Brooklyn Paper until I come up with my big idea. And then I could replace it and do something else. Well, a year into it, I was having a ball working on it. And I go, I think this is the thing I'll stick with, because it was a lot of fun to do. And without even thinking of it, it's like, wow, I'm a professional cartoonist. I have a published strip. But again, it was very raw. I remember Harvey and Will. It's like they're like in the comics. You'll see their heads over my head saying, "Too much technique. I can't read this from panel to panel. Too much copy." So it took me a couple of years to just get my sea legs with it. And in fact, when I got my first studio, I shared it with six or seven different artists. My advice to the young, never share with six or seven artists. Always limit yourself to one or two. But the other artists would ask what I would do, and I would say, oh, again, I do freelance illustration. And my friend Russell, the animator, goes, tell them about Wolf and Bird. And I didn't want to pull it out because I felt it wasn't ready yet. It just, even though it was being published, and there's nothing, there's no learning experience like seeing your work in cold print. And there's nothing you could do about all the, oh my God, right, what was I thinking? But as time goes on, you know what not to do or what to do. So 3 or 4 years into it, I get a call from the National Law Journal, which the editor-in-chief lived in Brooklyn Heights. He had seen the Brooklyn paper, and he loved the concept. And he said, why don't you do a presentation for the Law Journal? And, maybe we'll run it. So that, of course, it took me a year and a half to get together a presentation that I felt was not so much foolproof, but it's nothing anyone can, nothing I wouldn't be proud of reprinting. Right. And sure enough, I reprinted all that stuff. So anyway, I just want to finish.
You may want to back up just a little bit so we can, there you go.
This is my queen.
It's funny, I think I may have mentioned the first time we spoke years ago, I actually wrote for the National Law Journal for a while.
Oh yeah, that's right. What years?
Oh God, somewhere in the 90s, I think. It was probably one of those things I did before I was a parent. Look at her coming together.
Yeah, well, this is my signature character, and I apologize to her because I did it very hurriedly. This is Elena Wolf, and she is the lead partner in the law firm of Wolf and Bird, Counselors of the Macabre. And I've been doing their story since 1979. Hmm. The first strip started in 1979. And to bring it back to Will, the first collection of strips, by this time, by the mid-80s, I was confident enough to not only... Well, by this time, it was in the National Law Journal. They accepted my presentation. And I had a body of work that a small publisher, approached me and wanted to do a collection. Of course, I was very excited. And like Will, I went back to the old strips and redrew panels and touched it up and things like that. But when the book came out, my publisher said, say, you had Will Eisner for a teacher, didn't you? And I said, well, yeah. He goes, let's send him a copy and see if he'll give us a blurb. Now, I was terrified. And he goes, and while we're at it, let's send one to Harvey, too. They did. I said, they don't like my work. They don't think. I said, what could it hurt? And I said, oh. So I hadn't talked to them in years. I didn't know. But he was insistent. And I have to admit, one of my nicest memories was getting that letter back from Will that right away, because I think I wrote to Michael, you may not remember me, but I was in your first year class. And his opening line was, of course I remember you. And I cannot tell you how thrilled I am that you stuck with it. And your book looks wonderful. And this is my first collection. And this is the one that Will wrote the blurb for. And I got another letter from Harvey that he wrote back and said, you know, it just looks great, and I'm glad you're still with it. And, you know, and that was very, very exciting, you know. And a few years later, when I started going to conventions and really beginning to really feel my oats and feel, all right, I'm going to get an artist alley table and sell this book and promote myself and see if anyone wants sketches and everything, I would run into Will and Harvey. And I had long hair in college, believe it or not. And when I saw Harvey for the first time in 10 or 12 years, he looked at me and he said, "What happened to the hair?" And he remembered me. So that was nice.
Hey, people can't see me, but I'm pretty much bald now. But I had an afro in college.
Wow.
I had a giant afro on my head. So, yes, we all change over time, don't we?
Yes, for the better, I hope.
Yes. Well, you know, I have a sense that we could probably go another hour plus, but it just occurred to me that we've been talking a long time, and I don't want to wear out my welcome.
I feel like we barely touched. It should be more about Will than me.
No, I think we're good. I did want to ask you. Let me just ask you. Let me touch briefly because in the later years, you developed this. I'm assuming this whole different relationship with Will. Through Comic-Con and the awards. So I assume that you saw him at least once a year in the last years of his life.
We would the nice coincidence was I had known Will and I had connected with him when I started going to conventions and pushing my book. And he also knew Jackie. And when Will was... I can't remember the exact specifics, but Will was looking for someone to handle the Eisner Awards. And Comic-Con was going to take it under its wing, and they were looking for someone. And Dennis Kitchen, I think, recommended Jackie. And I just was getting to know her around this time. We were officially dating, but I was there when when Will asked her if she was interested in, and Will the Charmer, if she was interested in taking over, being the administrator of the Eisner Awards, because, and Jackie said, "Well, I'd be very interested. Maybe we should meet." Dennis said, "Oh, let's set up a breakfast or something." And Will takes Jackie's head in his hands and said, "Are you going to look this charming first thing in the morning?" And, you know, Will the Charmer. and from there, by this time, I was beginning to head into the world of comic books. And Wolf and Bird became a comic book. And I was phasing out the strip. So... And I would see Will at maybe more than once a year because I'd see him at different conventions. And we'd always have breakfast with him during Comic-Con. He would always look at every issue I did. He was on my comp list, and he'd always comment on something that he saw. He'd comment on something he liked, and he'd certainly commented on something he didn't like or thought I wasn't being clear about. But it was great. It was like I never left his class. And, you know, you always wanted to maybe not get his approval, but you always wanted to see, it's like, well, what does the master say about this? Harvey was ill by this point, so he wasn't as accessible as Will. Will did a lot of traveling, did a lot of conventions. And, I was just fortunate to know him. Both Jack and I were thrilled to be invited to his 80th birthday party, which was very exciting. I have a memory of Scott McCloud showing Will web comics and doing comics on the computer. And you could see Will kind of frowning, and he was always welcome to any new innovation. But he said, "I don't know, I think paper, pen and ink is my medium."
And yet he did come around after a while, because very late in his career, he encouraged Gary Schalliner to do John Law, which was done for modern, it was called Modern Comics. It was online, entirely online at first. And then it did come back around, as Will predicted. They did wind up doing it in print. But he was up for learning and taking it in. And
yeah. No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say the last thing I would say about that is that in the last year or two of his life and his career, because, of course, we all know he worked right up to the end, his right. wife, Anne, learned how to do lettering on the computer in the Will. There was someone created a Will Eisner font, and,
right.
and he was all for this. She learned. And so Mrs. Eisner, who never read any comics other than Will's for most of her life, wound up lettering his last few books on a computer. I mean, something we would never have expected would have happened.
Yeah, my big regret, and, you know, I think he was 88 when he passed away, but he wasn't an 88-year-old man. It was like talking to someone my age or even younger, because he is full of ideas, full of energy, and he was always looking ahead. I think that's what I admired really the most. And even now, whenever I see something new that happens with comics, or I mean, to be in SVA in the early 70s and have someone say, you know, the New York Times will be kissing the ass of comics in the year 2010, we'd say, yeah, sure. And we'll be on the moon. You know, we'll be having flying packs by then. But it's happened, and I just, you know, Will saw some of that. But the way, especially American society, has embraced comics, you know, Charles Brownstein of the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund had, I think, the best description of Eisner, which was he was like Moses. He died before he saw the promised land. And, you know, this was the environment I think he always envisioned. And if you can find articles about him in 1940s, and he talked about comics as a medium, right up there with literature and fine art, that it was, you know, you can tell any type of story or do anything with. And, you know, and I like to think he's still with us. Where every time you see a cartoonist on, I don't know, everywhere from late night talk shows to having a serious interview in the Washington Post, you know, that was always just pushing the pushing the good word.
All right. Well, listen, Batten, and folks, listen. You can find we didn't get really to. There it is again.
Yeah,
we didn't. We'll let it work its way.
Yes, it's 20 to the hour.
There we go.
So that means somewhere in the world
it's happy hour.
Yeah.
All right, so you can find collections of Batten Lash's work on Supernatural Law and other comics he's worked on. You can find, if you look, The Punisher meets Archie. Mavis, other comics he's done. You can order them in great stores everywhere, or you can order them right now at a great price right here on MrMedia.com. If you're watching on MrMedia.com, either to the left or to the right below the video, you'll see covers of Batten's fine work. You can click on it; it'll take you to it on Amazon, and you can order it right now. Batten, what are you working on these days? I didn't really get to ask you about current work.
Well, I am doing a strip for David Lloyd, half the brainchild of V for Vendetta. He has an online anthology called Aces Weekly. And for the first time in years, I have a brand new strip, and it's called The First Gentleman of the Apocalypse. And pretty much the high concept is Mad Max meets GQ. And so, you know, it's fun. Again, so something I did that has a lot of action, a lot of thugs, a lot of car crashes. So yeah, it's been fun. I get to do it in color, and I've been doing that. And I also did something called Gory Glory, which I didn't write. Again, it was just fun to just take someone's script, in this case, a talented young writer named Nick Blodgett, and just do his kind of trauma type story about a high school student in a post-apocalyptic high school. So I'm doing that, plus just trying to do the next segment of Supernatural Lore, Wolf and Bird Stories for their webcomic, which will be printed in trades, which I have now gone to color. So if I can plug my website.
Yes, I was just going to ask you, a website and any other online.
A more succinct version of what I just said could be found on exhibitapress.com.
Very good. And we'll have all the links down there, folks. And
thank you.
You can find. We'll connect you. We'll hook you up. We'll get you the hookup, as those kids
say. Thank you.
All right. Well, Bat and Lash, it was a delight to see you. I so appreciate the demonstration of the drawing and hearing your stories. And thank you so much for joining us in Mr. Media today.
Thank you, Bob. Something about Anne I wanted to say in the interview, that she is so adorable. I think a couple of years before Will passed away, she just said to us, you know, she goes, I loved Will. I didn't care if he was a plumber, cartoonist. That was just what he did. I just loved him. So I never really read anything he did. But just recently, I started reading The Spirit. And you know what? They're really good. I remember him saying to me that he really missed Harvey, you know, and now I'm saying to people, I really miss Will, you know, just chatting with him. And I can reveal now I wore this tie in honor of The Spirit. Jackie always says that I talk with my hands, so you just may see a lot of fine, but I'll do my best.